Thank you, sir. I am Virgil Warren, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Mr. Joe Hubbard for inviting me out. I always say Mr. Hubbard because I was raised to show respect for my elders. You know, Joe and I went to school together, drank together, and then went our separate ways and didn't see each other until we wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous together. I said that I was an alcoholic. I am a sober alcoholic, sober by the grace of God and through the instrument that He chose to grant me this sobriety. That is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I look back on my life, sometimes it seems many, many years ago, when I sat at the arm of my mother's chair and had her read to me of Peter and Luke and John. Mother's highest ambition and dream for her eldest son was for him to become a Methodist minister. Her dreams, her ambitions became mine. And up until I was 17 years old and a junior in boys' high school here in Atlanta, this is the type of life that I lived. And I began to notice around the schools and at the dances that the boys and girls begin to refer to me as a panty waist. And it hurt, and I couldn't understand. Inasmuch as I played on the baseball, football, and basketball teams, how an athlete could be a panty waist. Nevertheless, that's what they called me. And one night, I was at a dance here in Atlanta, and I noticed these boys and girls ever so often would run out of the dance to their automobiles. And when they came back, they seemed to be laughing and cutting up and having a lot more fun than they did when they went out to those cars. And this night I followed some of them out. And I noticed that they were drinking corn whiskey, chasing it with Coca-Cola and ginger ale. And I asked one of those boys, "Give me a drink of that." And he handed me this bottle and a Coca-Cola. And I took my first drink at the age of 17, standing beside that car. Now, I have heard a lot of people stand before these rostrums or in discussion meetings and say that they became an alcoholic 4, 5, 6 years before they came to the program of AA. Now, that's their opinion, and they're entitled to it. And I don't want to get in any controversy with them about it. But I believe they're talking about compulsive or pathological alcoholism. I believe that when I took that first drink standing beside that automobile, that I became allergic to alcohol. because from that point on, I did not want to associate with anybody or go anywhere that there wasn't drinking involved. Almost immediately, I found out what a panty waste was, and all of my old friends immediately became panty waste to me. I continued on through high school, and it came time to graduate. And it finally dawned on me one day, Virgil, you're going to graduate from this school in June, and then in September, you're going off to theological seminary to become a Methodist minister. And you know, that scared me and worried me, because I knew by then that Methodists were a bunch of narrow-minded people anyway. They kind of frowned on those ministers, their ministers running around with girls and getting in fights and getting drunk. And when we graduated that year, another boy and I ran away from home. We ran out through the West and into Mexico and into California. And just before Christmas that year, this feeling came to me to go home. I didn't know what it was then, I do now. And this boy and I hitchhiked across the United States back home. And upon arriving home, I was welcomed back as if I'd been down to the corner grocery after a loaf of bread, and life took back over again as it had. And then in February of that year, it really dawned on me what I had been called home for, because this mother that I loved so much passed away. And I can recall at that particular time, already at this early age, that mother was the one that wanted me to be a Methodist minister and not me. It was her idea. And now I won't have to be. But then of August that year, my father called me to him. Said, Virgil, we've got to go to town and buy you some clothes to go off to school in September. And I recall getting my first resentments. I couldn't believe that my father wanted me to go off to theology school. I preferred to believe he wanted to get rid of me because he was a young man. Nevertheless, off to school in September, I went. I went to this theology seminary for almost a year. And I came home one weekend, and I got to thinking to myself, now you tell me if this is not alcoholic thinking and alcoholic action at the age of 19. I began to tell myself, Virgil, you've been studying awful hard in that school. You've not been eating well. You're not sleeping well. And if you just had a drink every night, you'd be all right. It would relax you and you'd be all right. And I went by a bootlegger and bought a flat fifth of whiskey, and I carried it back to school with me, and I did exactly what an alcoholic would do. I got drunk and caused the disturbance in the dormitory that night. I was told by one of the professors to report to the dean at 10 o'clock the next morning And I reported to this fine man's office, and he sat behind his desk and read me the riot act as he should have. And when he was through and at the end of it, he looked at me and he said, Virgil, I had intended to expel you from this college where you couldn't attend another one in the state of Georgia. But after looking at your record, I'm going to give you the privilege of resigning. And I asked that man what it was in my record that deserved such a thing. And he said to his amazement that I was leading my class. Now, what kind of person is it that would lead his class in theology college and go off and get a quart of corn whiskey and get drunk and raise hell? And another attribute of an alcoholic came to me at that time, ego. Little did this man know that he was talking to a blooming alcoholic, but he was, and he whetted my ego. And I was on my way home from that school, I began to think about what had happened. And I wondered what kind of a school did the Methodist Church have. That here I was, a young man, that their own admission could have been one of the greatest ministers that the denomination had ever known, and they asked for my resignation. Then I wanted to know how God could do this to me. Here I was, a young man that was willing to dedicate my life to preaching his gospel, and he let this happen to me. And I knew they were both wrong, because being a great student of that Bible, I knew the 31st Proverbs, the 7th verse says, go out into the world and get drunk and forget your hunger and poverty. Now, you drunks didn't know that was in there, did you? What better excuse do you want to get drunk than the Bible tells you so? But how much I learned about this later when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. All of we alcoholics can find an excuse for our actions. And in finding that excuse, we ignore any and everything around it. Just that one excuse. How many people have I seen in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous will pick out a sentence or a paragraph in the big book and misquote it out of context just to prove a point that the book is wrong? They ignore the rest of the chapter. They ignore the preceding paragraph. Just as I had ignored the previous verse to that one. And that verse reads, if you are intent on self-destruction, I came on back to Atlanta, and I entered into another phase of an alcoholic. I wanted to prove something to somebody. And I entered Georgia Tech. And after 2 years, I had decided that Georgia Tech had taught me everything that it had to offer. And I needed to get out, and I needed to go to work, and I needed to make a place in life that I was capable of and deserving of. When the real truth in the matter was, you can't go to Georgia Tech and pass and get drunk every night, and it's awful hard to become an alcoholic on the money that your daddy allows you to go to school with. But nevertheless, I got out of Georgia Tech and went to work for one of Georgia's larger corporations. I need not tell you too much about the next 18 years of my life, except that I worked awful hard to become an alcoholic. And that each and every one of us have a given amount of time that we can be successful in spite of a bottle of alcohol. Now, I want to emphasize those words, in spite of a bottle of alcohol. I've never seen anyone successful with a bottle of alcohol. But in that 18-year period of time, which was mine, some people have 5 years, some eight, some 10, in spite of a bottle of alcohol, I was successful for 18 years and became assistant to the president and in charge of production and engineering of this corporation. In the meantime, I met my wife, Margaret, and we were married. I might as well give you a little statistics in here now. As of March the 4th of this year, I was 66 years old. And the reason there's not too much gray hair in my head is because it was pickled in alcohol before it had a chance to turn gray. Also, on the January the 4th of this year, my wife and I were married for 45 years. She and I have decided that we're going to fight this thing out to the bitter end. But at the end of that 18th year, when I had achieved this success, the president of this corporation had resigned. And it was very evident that a board of directors meeting had to be called to elect a new president. And it was called. And the chairman of the board of this corporation made two statements directed at me, and they ran off of my back like water off of a duck's back. He made the statement that he was not going to name a president at that time, that he was going to wait 6 months and see what transpired and happened. Another ambitious man in that room got up and asked him if he had any idea who the new president would be. And he said, yes, that Virgil would be the next president if he handed his cigars out in the proper manner. Virgil went out for the next 6 months and celebrated the fact that he had become president of this corporation. And I was sitting in my office one morning when my secretary came in to me and said, Mr. Warren, the chairman of the board wants to see you in his office. And I knew what he wanted. So I got up and combed my hair and straightened my tie, put my coat on, and walked up to his office to accept the presidency of this corporation. And when I walked through that door again, a very kindly gray-haired gentleman was sitting behind his desk. But this time, tears was running down his cheeks. And he looked up at me and he said, Virgil, I had hoped and I had prayed that I would never have to say this to you, but I must ask for your resignation. I recall, and I have inventoried that time standing in that man's office door. I have changed my opinion on it in the early part of my tenure in AA. But now I know, as I stood in that door, that I was sick. Sick to my heart, sick in my head, sick in my stomach. My knees were weak. That man had just taken away from me the ultimate success in my life. But I had become an alcoholic. And I had built a shell around me that I wouldn't let anybody penetrate. I couldn't let people know how I felt. I couldn't let people know when they hurt me. And I looked this man right straight in the eye and I said, well, that's great. Who did you elect president? And he told me. And I said, well, that's fine, because if you'd fired him, he would have starved to death. And I can make more money than your presidency calls for, and I'll prove it to you. And little did I know when I made the statement to that man that that was the beginning of the end. I went out on the road traveling the southeastern states as a manufacturer's agent. And after 2 years, I was making more money than the presidency called for that corporation. And I called him up and told him I wanted an appointment with him, and he's very happy to see me. And I walked into his office and I slammed these papers down on his desk and I said, see there, you were wrong. And little again did I know when I laid those papers down on his desk that that was the beginning of my swan song. Because as I traveled over the southeastern states and called on my distributors, I used to laugh and talk about how I carried them out and entertained them, carried them out and told them how I drank with them to get this business. And then all of a sudden, as I traveled the territory and called on these distributors, when night came and I invited them out to dinner, they began to refuse. I had to learn that these men, I wasn't drinking with them, they were drinking with me. And when I began to embarrass them everywhere we went, then they didn't want any more part of me. And I resented them for it. And this led me to sitting in a hotel room all alone, drinking by myself, the loneliest life in the world for an alcoholic, looking at four walls, learning how to hate and despise and resent people. Never one time thinking or even giving a thought to the fact that maybe it was mine and maybe if I would quit drinking, it would stop. And along about this time is when the hallucinations began, and when the blackouts began. Incidentally, I asked a doctor friend of mine one time, how many blackouts you had to have before it began to affect your mind? And he told me 3. So I think it only fair from this point on to let you know that you are listening to a blithering idiot. And then the hallucinations came. I constantly listened to music. Many, many times I've driven down the road in my automobile listening to hillbilly music and get tired of it. I want to listen to some classical music and reach over and push the button on the radio and change it to classical music. And the radio wasn't even on. Now between these hallucinations and between these blackouts, I began running scared. Only God will know how many times I got up out of a hotel room and dressed and checked out and drove 200 or 300 miles and waked up in another hotel and never remembered leaving the last one. And as this went on, I began to be more concerned, and sitting in that room talking about people, I even turned back to God again, and I knew that God wasn't going to help me because I had turned my back on Him and was not presenting any effort whatsoever to deserve His help. I was like that little boy, still sitting back at the arm of my mother's chair. And I so much wanted to look up at her and say, "Mother, your little boy is in trouble. Won't you please tell him what to do?" But you know, we can't run back to Mother again. This is our problem. This was my problem. And I alone was the only person on the face of this earth that could do anything about it. And I didn't know how. I wanted out of this mess. It reminds me of a story of a salesman that came storming down from his room in his hotel one morning and slammed his suitcase down in front of the desk clerk and said, "Oh, buddy, this is the last time I ever stay in your hotel." And the clerk said, "Well, sir, what is the matter?" And he said, "Well, I didn't sleep a wink last night, not one wink. And the clerk said, "Well, sir, what was the matter?" He said, "Well, it was some dizzy blonde beating on my door all night long last night." The clerk said, "Well, why didn't you get up and find out what she wanted?" He said, "I knew what she wanted. She wanted out." That's what I wanted. I wanted out, but I didn't know how. I only knew one thing. I knew that back home that I had a keeper. And you know, you can show me any alcoholic in the world and I don't have to look around very far to find the keeper. Each and every one of us has got somebody somewhere that we can run back to when nobody else in the world that wants us. When nobody in the world wants any part of us. And I figured that I had a keeper at home and I could run back home and she'd take care of me. The only problem was that I didn't realize while I was out on the road becoming an alcoholic that she was at home becoming an alcoholic. Now, I can't tell her story, but she's going to have to get in this one slightly right here. And I want to tell you something, that if you've never had the experience of two alcoholics living in the same home, you have missed something. I don't recommend in any manner that you go back and try it, but nevertheless, you've missed something. My wife and I lived in that house. Sometimes we'd pass each other and not even speak. Sometimes we would speak to each other like perfect strangers. I can recall many times waking up in the bed in the dark in a cold sweat and looking out into that dark and afraid of what was in it, and yet afraid not to know what was in it, yet to lay there and shake. And the only thing that could get me out of that bed was a compulsion of alcoholism, cunning, baffling, powerful alcohol. And I would throw my legs over the side of that bed and go back to that kitchen and look under the sink for a drink. And sometimes there wasn't a drink there. And then I'd go back and wake my wife up and curse her out and for taking the last drink out of the bottle. Then I'd look at my watch, and maybe it was 4 o'clock in the morning. And I knew the liquor stores didn't open till 8. And I'd begin to pace that 4 in the longest 4 hours that God ever put on the face of this earth. Pace that floor stinking, smelling, hadn't had a bath or changed clothes, maybe for a week or 10 days. Holding my arms up and saying, "Oh God, how can you do this to me?" Long about this time, the knocks began to come on our door. My family, her family, wanting to help us and not knowing how. And we resented every one of them. And then the ministers began to come, these wonderful friends of the cloth. And they would come in and they would sit down on the settee with me and they would begin to talk. And they would tell me, "Virgil, you've got to believe. You've got to have faith in God. You've got to ask for God's help. You have got to get down on your knees and pray." But these wonderful men of the cloth didn't understand either. They didn't realize that Virgil didn't have anything left to pray with. But there was one that did know. And that one was God. And God knew that if Virgil was going to find sobriety, he would have to create one of his miracles. And he did. Because a knock came to our door on one Sunday around noon. And when I opened that door, there stood a man and a woman dressed up like they were going to church. And they were. Two, a man and a woman that Margie and I had quit associating with because in our opinion they were hopeless drunks. And yet there they stood. And they came into the living room and they sat down and they began to tell us that they had been in the Decatur group of Alcoholics Anonymous, sober for 2 months, and how much that they wished that Margaret and I would go with them. Now they insulted my intelligence to think that they were putting me in their category. But my wife was more gullible than I was. She fell for all of that line of hogwash, hook, line, and sinker. She went back in the bedroom and she put her clothes on and she went with them. And she's got 4 more months sobriety than I have. And she just pulls her seniority on me all the time. She'd go to those meetings on Thursday nights and Sunday afternoons, and she'd come back, and I'd be sitting in my drunk chair. And I'd look up at her, and I'd say, "Well, Margaret, how are your drunk friends tonight? Or how are those drunks you're associating with?" But the coup de grace came when she came in one Sunday afternoon and I was sitting there and I pointed my finger at her and I said, "Margaret, do you realize that you are ruining my reputation?" A few Sundays after that, this man and woman came back to our door again. And he told me, he said, "Virgil, I'm going to chair my first meeting at Decatur this afternoon. And I sure wish you would come and go with me." Well, my thoughts were, if it would help him, I think I ought to be gracious enough to go with him. And also, I was curious about who my wife was associating with. So I dressed and went with him, and I sat on the back row of that AA meeting, and I looked out over all of these hypocrites. I didn't believe a word any of them had to say. Slapping each other on the back and saying, "I love you," and kissing each other and all that crap, it made me sick to my stomach. I knew that every cotton picking one of them was going to leave there and go home and take a drink. And the reason I knew it was because I was. And I didn't like it. But you know, Margaret kept bringing me. I'd stay sober for a week or 10 days. She'd carry me to these AA meetings for a week or 10 days, and this just kept on and on. Finally, she told me at Christmas time, our group has an eating meeting and celebrated Christmas. And she informed me that I was going to that eating meeting, that Christmas celebration, sober, drunk, or hungover. I was going. And I went hungover. And I sat on the back row and watched that bunch of idiots again. Eating, of all things. Drinking coffee and that same old crap. Loving each other and a hugging and a kissing and a rubbing up against, as Doc Mooney said. It made me sick. But being brilliant, the thought rang through my mind, "Virgil, you have got a world of knowledge of alcoholism in the palm of your hand. If you will just wake up and listen, find out the mistakes that these people made, don't make them, and then you can drink successfully." And I stayed sober the entire month of January, and I listened. And sometimes I even asked questions if I didn't hear exactly what I wanted to hear or didn't understand exactly what I wanted to understand. And after that month was over, on the 1st of February, I packed my bag and I got in my car and I headed out for Savannah, Georgia to have a slip. And I pulled up late Monday afternoon in front of the old DeSoto Hotel in Savannah. I threw my bags in my room and went down to the Sapphire Room, and I had me 2 bottles of beer. I had me a good dinner. I bought me a magazine, and I went to bed. And about 10 or 10:30, I was congratulating myself very highly on what I had accomplished. Those people told me two drinks would make me drunk, and I had had 2. And there I was, like a normal person. I worked hard all day Tuesday. Tuesday night I came back in and changed those 2 bottles of beer to 3 vodka martinis. I had me a good dinner, got me another magazine, and went back to bed. And again, about 10 or 10:30, I was congratulating myself very highly on what I had accomplished. Said, "See there, Virgil, 2 nights in a row, and you're laying up here like a normal person." And for having accomplished such a thing, you deserve a nightcap. And I got up Tuesday night and put my clothes back on and went back to the Sapphire Room. And then on Friday night, there was some knocks on my door. 2 men from the Savannah group of Alcoholics Anonymous, Cornel and Uncle Fred. Uncle Fred has long been passed away now. But they came to stay with me till my eventual sponsor could come and get me. And he showed up late Saturday evening, came into my room and helped me pack my bag, checked me out of the hotel, put me in the car, and we headed back to Atlanta. Alcoholic Presbyterian minister that had to preach a sermon in his church on Sunday morning. It made a round trip of 550 miles to get a drunk out of a hotel that he hardly knew. We talked nearly all the way back from Savannah. And I hear so many people say that you can't talk to a drunk. Well, I'm living testimony standing here. If you can't talk to a drunk, I wouldn't have been here. No, I have no idea what all that Russell said to me or I to him on the way back from Savannah. But he rung a bell with me. He said the thing that waked me up with this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Virgil, if you ever expect to find sobriety, there's 3 things you've got to do." He said, "First, you've got to believe that you can quit drinking and have faith that you can work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Secondly, you've got to believe that the people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous will help you, and you have got to have faith that they will." And he said, "Third, you have got to have faith in God. You cannot work this program by yourself. You do not have the strength to work this program. But you got to believe that God will give you this strength if you ask Him." Russell brought me back in the wee hours of Sunday morning and deposited me at my door and helped my wife lead me over to my drunk chair and sat me down in it. And I sat there for 2 long days and nights sweating out this last drunk. And as I sat there one night, I heard the words faith come out of a TV set. Those words, that word faith seemed to leap out of that TV set is to say, Virgil, wake up and listen. This is what you have been waiting for. And I waked up and I listened, and of all things, it was a Yancey Derringer program. And on that program with Yancey Derringer was an old man. And the old man had told Yancey that he was going out west to find a gold mine. And Yancey had asked him how he was going to find it. And the old man replied, by faith. And then Yancey asked the old man what faith was. The old man replied that faith was the evidence of things not seen and the substance of things hoped for. I got up out of my chair, went into my den, and picked up my Bible that I hadn't had my hands on in 25 years. And without hesitation, turned the 11th chapter, the first verse of Hebrews. This was the verse that the old man had quoted. I carried it back to my chair and I sat and read the entirety of that chapter. And without a doubt, it has more evidences of faith of characters of the Bible than any part of it. That was on February 5th, 1960. And I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since that day. I went back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wish that I could report to you that I was a good member, but I wasn't. I was a hard-headed Dutch Irishman, and I was going to do it my way. I heard so many people get up before these rostrums and say, if you don't like what you hear here, forget it. And I was forgetting it. And I was hearing them say, if you don't like the second step, skip it, take the fifth. And I was skipping it. And you can work this program any way you want to. Work it the way you want to work it. And that's what I was doing. And after about 9 months, I was on the verge of getting drunk. And I had begun to realize it, thank God. And during that 9-month period, I had no use for a sponsor. I didn't need one of them either. I didn't need this man that had come to get me. But I was absolutely scared to death. I knew I was going to get drunk if something didn't happen. And I got in my car and I ran to this man. And thank God he was sitting behind his desk in his office. And I sat there for 30 minutes and poured out my heart to him. And when I stopped, he looked across the desk at me, put his head in his hand, and he said, I just want to ask you one question. Who in the hell do you think you are? And he made me mad. But he intended to make me mad. He had to get my attention like hitting the old mule between the eyes with a 2x4. He got my attention and I became teachable sitting across the desk from this man who I love so much today as my sponsor. And we began to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back in the program and began to look around, and one of the most amazing things that ever happened to me, I began to see love in the eyes of those hypocrites in that Decatur group. And it scared me. And I ran to Russell and I told Russell about it. And Russell laughed and he said, "Virgil, you don't really realize what it is, do you?" And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Virgil, you are seeing the reflection of your own love in those people's eyes. You are growing to the point that you are beginning to love those people. And you can't receive love until you give love first. You've got to start giving it away." And I begin to grow. Begin to work the steps. I see old Joseph back there about to ring a bell, so I'm going to have to skip some of my story and cut this off. But I have heard so much discussion about working the 12 steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I do want to tell you what has helped me so much in working the 12 steps and learning how to work the 12 steps. It is a story about a man going down to Sears Roebuck and buying himself a do-it-yourself kit for a rocking chair and bringing it back home with him and laying it on the floor and sitting down on his settee and looking at it. And you know, he could sit there till he got corns all over his fanny. That box would still be laying on the floor. But if he'll get up off of it and open the top of it, he'll find on the inside a list of instructions to put that chair together with. And those instructions are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4 on down the line. Now, if he takes that list of instructions and begins to skip about on them from 1 to 5 to 3 to 7 to 2 to 8, it's going to be impossible for him to put a chair together. In fact, if he puts anything together at all, it's going to resemble a mess. But if he follows those instructions the way they're numbered, it says, "We guarantee you can put this chair together." So he puts the chair together, and when he gets it together, he is so proud of that chair because he and he alone put it together. It's his handiwork. And then once he gets this chair put together, he can begin to sand it and shellac it and rub it and wax it until he has got a sight that is beautiful to behold. And then he can sit in that chair and be comfortable and content and happy. In the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we got a book called The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And on the inside of it, if you will just open it up and look, you will find the greatest set of instructions to sobriety that God ever bestowed upon the mind of two men. Now, if you don't follow those steps the way they're written, 1, 2, 3, 4, if you skip about on them, you're going to have an Alcoholics Anonymous program that's a mess. If you've got any kind of a program at all, it's going to be a mess. But this book says that if you follow these steps, we guarantee you sobriety. That's what the book says. And when you work those 12 steps and you find sobriety, then you can begin to work on your maturity. You can begin to learn how to live. You can find serenity and peace and happiness and comfort in your new way of life. This is what I found in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what I have found in working this program and working these steps. It has given me a life that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world. Before I came into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was broke. Had lost everything that I had. Margaret and I were living in an apartment with 4 months' rent due on it. And we had a notice from the landlord of these apartments to move. And we didn't have any place to move. And if we had a place to move, we didn't have anything to move with. In my tenure in Alcoholics Anonymous, through sobriety in this program, I have found my way back. And last May was a year ago I retired. And Margaret and I are living very happy, very comfortably, very peacefully, serenity in our life. And it's all over to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's there for you. Anybody that wants it, it's there. God bless you and thank you for listening.